The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning and welcome to Nature Nuggets here on Radio Kingston. I'm Chris Baker, filling in for Laurel Sutherland for the whole month of February. Radio Kingston's commitment to building community and helping us feel a sense of belonging in the place where we live brings so much joy and connection to the Kingston area. Laurel started the Nature Nuggets show to help expand that definition of community to embrace our more than human kin, and to help folks learn more about our ecology and the plants, animals, fungi, and even the microorganisms we're so lucky to share this land with every day. It's always an honor to fill in for Laurel on the show because his mission for Nature Nuggets feels very in line with the other work that I do. I'm an author, an outdoor educator, and the founder of Chicory Naturalist, which is a nature-focused book and gift shop on the Kingston waterfront, specifically at 25 Broadway. We carry a lovingly curated selection of books and guides for all ages and a wide variety of interests, as well as board games, gear, toys, art supplies, locally made gifts, really anything that'll help folks learn about and appreciate nature. There are comfy seats and a play area in the back so folks can come and read and relax, and we host a lot of community events throughout the year. We really try to have a little something for everyone because, after all, nature is for everyone. And now more than ever, our living world needs every one of us to take an interest. As Laurel says, people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. Okay, so now it's time for Who's About Town, which is a segment much like the Society Pages, but like for people who consider trees celebrities. And today, I'd love to draw our attention to some hopeful, abundant, and easy to find this time of year phenomena, which is the buds on the trees. Although we, or at least I, used to think of buds as being springtime phenomena, they're actually form in autumn, before the leaves are even off the trees. In preparation for their dormancy, trees put their energy into creating buds, which are really little packets of meristem. And meristem is a plant-specific kind of stem cell, meaning it's capable of becoming many kinds of plant tissues. Not too long from now in the spring, these buds are going to swell and become more noticeable as they start to fill to bursting with furled flower petals and leaves, but for now they're still small and easy to overlook. That said, paying attention to buds is a really great way to ID trees in the wintertime. Depending on the shape, size, and placement of the buds on the branches, you can tell what type of tree you're looking at without ever seeing a leaf, and without, you know, kind of like scrying the bark, which I still find pretty challenging. If you'd like to try your hand at winter tree ID using buds, there's a handy little free printable key from the University of Wisconsin that you can either look up, or I'll also link it in the show notes when we put the show up. Tree ID pairs pretty nicely with bird watching, which is relevant since this weekend we have the event we've been talking about all month here on Nature Nuggets. It's finally here. It's the Great Backyard Bird Count. And I know the weather is a little dreary today, and either we're going to get a foot of snow or a little bit of rain tomorrow, depending on who you believe. But the birds are out regardless. Just this morning, I saw goldfinches, cardinals, and my favorite little dark-eyed juncos in my yard. And the Great Backyard Bird Count is actually a global event. It takes place this weekend every year, and it activates bird watchers and community scientists of every stripes, which absolutely could include you, to observe and count the birds in their own neck of the woods. And you submit that data either to eBird or to Merlin, which are two great bird watching apps. And we've talked about Merlin, I think, maybe almost every single episode of Nature Nuggets because it's great. Sort of like Shazam for birds. And once you submit that data, it gets used by ornithologists, conservation biologists, and many others to help know what's happening with bird populations and protect them. So you can check out birdcount.org for more information about how to get involved this weekend. And if you like the idea but you don't feel confident making those observations on your own, or you just want to meet other bird nerds, you can also find lots of places to plug in with community on the John Burroughs Natural History Society website, which is jbnhs.org. and head to the events tab. We have a walk along the Roundout Creek looking at some weird ducks leaving from Chicoree Naturalist tomorrow at 9 a.m., although that's pretty rain dependent, so we'll see how it goes. Okay, so today I am absolutely thrilled that our guest, Ajoy, agreed to join me in the studio. Her work is really an inspiration to me, and she supports and amplifies so many voices that we all need to hear from in this moment in history. Kate Rose Wiener, am I pronouncing that correctly? Okay, great. Is a writer, editor, publisher working at the intersection of culture and climate justice. She is the co-editor of Loam, which is the publishing branch of the Weaving Earth Center for Relational Education, as well as the director of Loam Library, which is a mobile library committed to bringing the power of print to the people, which you can find locally in the Hudson Valley. Kate's work is shaped by her studies in environmental art, social practice, and community herbalism. She is a 2023 editorial fellow at the Center for Humans and Nature, a 2021 artist and activist in residence at the Boulder Public Library, and a 2018 spiritual ecology fellow. In collaboration with Kalia Lofton, Kate is currently writing Compassion in Crisis, an immersive and intersectional field guide to navigating climate disaster. She is also working with artist Amirio Freeman on developing a second iteration of the Down to Earth deck, a series of conversation cards curated to reignite ritual. Thank you so much for being here, Kate.
Thank you, Chris.
It's really a joy. So to start off, I would like to ask guests if there's any nature observations that you'd like to share with listeners today. I know we're kind of deep in midwinter at this point, but...
I think for me, what I'm really falling in love with right now is actually the water in winter. I was just at a river this morning, and... the flow of ice is exquisite right now.
It really is.
Like the ice caves, the shades of blue, the interplay between the movement of the river and the parts that were frozen. I was just like, this is stunning and a part of winter I always really love.
And every day different, right?
You
can go back to the same spot and find new art.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's constantly changing and it's just so beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. I even feel like when I can't get down to the river, just we have a very mucky, low point in our yard that I'm like, it always has interesting, interesting ice as I'm walking across. So I'm curious, some of these questions I don't know the answer to yet, which I'm excited. I'm curious how you came into relationship with plants initially, and if your connection to the earth and our more than human kin is something that you were raised with from the beginning, or if it's something that you experienced an awakening of along the way?
I think it's always been a part of me. I grew up in, you know, the suburbs of New York City, but I had a very nature-based childhood in the sense that both my brother and I went to a nature-based after-school program and spent a lot of our time in this little sliver of woods in the suburbs that felt very magical to me. I think a lot of it was actually, both my parents love to be outside and I think are big advocates for connecting to nature wherever you are, whether it's in the city, in the country. But I think a lot of it was I had a brother who loved to be outside. He loved, he built a little kind of hut in our backyard to sleep in,
At what age?
Oh my God, I think he was like 10, so I would have been 7. So like, I think there was always a lot of, we spent a lot of time climbing trees. We spent a lot of time, learning about foraging, walking through the woods. So I think that was really a formative part of my childhood. And, I still am close with my mentors through that program to this day. And I learned so much from them about how to show up to the world regardless of where you are. I think for a lot of people, right, like they have this idea that you can connect to nature in certain places and not others, but yeah. I got to feel really connected where I was and I feel very grateful for that.
I love that. And I think that's so, I wish that there was more. I mean, I'm always trying to cultivate that emphasis that nature isn't just like the deep woods or, a full meadow unbroken by human contact. It's like, since we are nature, the places where we live are also
totally
also nature.
Yeah.
And So along the way, when did you sort of decide? I mean, I'm assuming because you're a writer and an editor, and I feel like that's usually something that comes a little pre-programmed for people, or at least is like deep in their childhoods. But when did you decide to devote your writing and editorial work to climate justice?
Well, yeah, I'll definitely say writing and editing very much feel, and publishing feel like an ancestral inheritance. My dad's a third generation printer, so I grew up with that. You know, my mom's a writer and editor. So books were always a part of my life, and I always was really inspired and excited by publishing and the power of print. And I think it really solidified in college. I found so much joy in making DIY zines to share with my community around culture and climate justice. And weaving the two together was very joyful and collaborative for me, and I think felt like a natural intersection of my passions.
So Loam, like the roots of Loam were actually in a college zine.
Yeah, Loam is actually, yeah. I had started it in college, and it was like a DIY zine, which now I just cringe thinking about it because I had no idea how to, you know, like put something together. But whatever, you're figuring it out when you're in college, you know. But I just remember like trying to do it on a Word document and like, you know. But we did that, and we made vertical gardens around campus. Like it was kind of this immersive gardening meets DIY zine.
Oh my gosh.
Vibe.
So there were like, yeah, there were other manifestations besides the print part of it.
Yeah, like we had vertical gardens and we grew herbs that were free for folks to take. And then we had this like DIY zine we distributed, and we did little dinners, and that was kind of the vibe.
That's a lovely vibe. Where did you go to college?
I went to Wesleyan.
Oh, cool. So regional, if not local. That's, yeah, also kind of inspirational for any teenagers listening, potentially, the thing that's your passion might actually be your job.
Yeah, totally.
So if listeners aren't familiar with Loam, I know that now you are the publishing branch of Weaving Earth, which is a change the past year, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of publications already under the belt, and they're very beautiful. So could you tell listeners a little bit more about Loam, and also like what kinds of offerings you've done throughout the years?
Yeah, absolutely. So Loam is a community-powered publishing project. Like I shared, our roots are in DIY zines. It's surreal now that we've been around for over a decade.
Also, just for reference, you would not know that the roots are in DIY zines looking at. They're very like beautifully bound volumes.
That's because over the years I've had actual designers really who know what they're doing.
Not that like I love the scene aesthetic too, but you know, these are like very
totally.
These are keepsake volumes for sure.
Yeah. But I think we've had many evolutions. For nearly a decade we were kind of independently run. Maybe 8 years ago now, I connected with my dear friend, Kailea Lofton, who's an incredible climate justice organizer and brilliant writer and thinker and mother. And I think together we have been really able to move Loam in a new direction as a publishing company. And through the support of the Spiritual Ecology Fellowship, which is how we both first connected, we were able to kind of grow this DIY zine into a place to create not just an annual magazine, which for a few years was kind of our main focus, but books on nourishing the nervous system, on community gardening, anthologies on living through liminality. We've done so many collaborative projects. We've been able to curate workshops and events and learning cohorts together. It's been a really beautiful and juicy decade of creative collaboration. And more recently, in the last year, we rehomed within the Weaving Earth Center for Relational Education, which is an incredible nonprofit in Northern California that does relational-based education for our times and has programs for youth and for adults, and I think and teens, you know, they do a lot around reigniting ritual, connecting to ancestral wisdom, nourishing earth intimacy. And I think that merger doesn't feel like quite the right word, but that rehoming has been so beautiful as we envision the next 10 years of Loam, because we really want our written work to be contextualized within an educational framework and to create materials that support a new way of showing up for this time.
I feel like symbiosis, or like a new symbiosis, maybe better than a merger.
Yeah, exactly. We're like, merger's not it. But yeah, symbiosis.
I wanted to go back to a phrase that you used that I don't know if a lot of listeners might be familiar with, but I think is so, I don't know, like such a fertile phrase, which is spiritual ecology. And I know it's part of a fellowship, but could you talk a little bit more about what spiritual ecology is?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think it's very much an emergent and evolving field, and that I do feel like the definition might shift. Mm-hmm. But the way that I relate to it is spiritual ecology is an understanding that the climate crisis is as much a crisis of connection as it is a result of extractive industries and all of the extractive systems, and that, you know, disconnection from our spiritual selves, from our spiritual communities, is one of the contributing factors to climate crisis.
Yeah, and I know that takes so many different forms, yeah. But drilling it a little bit, like I guess, is it like about more the relationship between consumerism and like and filling the void that used to be more filled with our connections to other living organisms?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think again, there are so many different ways to relate to it, and I think it's, for that reason, a complicated term, because I think, yeah, there's many different ways to express it. But I'll say that one way I think we're in the practice of it at Loam is we're really curious about what it would look like to center compassion in our relations, and in a way that kind of, you know, compassion is a very overused term. So I understand that some people, you know, might feel like it doesn't have the necessary edge to meet this moment. So we, you know, welcome and honor that as well. But for us, I think it's a way of recognizing that we can be really punitive and harsh with each other. We can replicate the same systems that we're trying to dismantle, and that centering compassion in our work as like a real value, as a real practice, is one way of challenging what we don't want.
Yeah, I think that's such an, it is hard, the limits of language with, yeah, with like totally. Compassion, where, you know, any word after you hear it enough times, you know, kind of loses some of its meaning. But I just totally agree that the intent behind that never goes out of style.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is a real deep embodied practice, and it is a radical practice. And yeah, it is something. Language is hard. I feel that more and more being in a space, right, of writing and editing, is that I'm really coming up against the limits of language right now and the need for new words and ways of expressing and how to work within the confines of language, yeah. While also pushing for a new vocabulary.
Right, and keeping it legible for mm-hmm. people, you know, I think that there's some, which is kind of why I wanted to drill down on spiritual ecology, because I think there's a lot of work that's come out of that area that's been really meaningful to me. But then, like, my background is in anthropology, and I think one of the main reasons that I ended up not wanting to pursue that field professionally was that I felt like, although we had within the field, I was not part of, while the intellectual trajectory of anthropology had managed to create all these amazing ways of looking at systems and power and communicating about what forms culture and what culture forms, that the ways that we spoke about it were totally illegible to, mm-hmm. like, even I could not talk about the theses that I was writing to even close friends and family, much less like someone that I would just meet at a party or something. So yeah. I was like, what is the, yeah, it's like, it's only meaningful if you can, if it's shared, really. Yeah.
I really relate to that because I also studied anthropology, and I think the emphasis on theory felt really alienating to me. And one of the things I loved about my anthropology program is it was very much about doing fieldwork in the community that you came from, which I really appreciated because I think that's a departure from a lot of traditional anthropology.
Like where that would actually be stigmatized.
Yeah, like it was like work with your community, you know, like I loved that. It felt like a really, yeah, it felt really important. And I also, yeah, really struggled with the emphasis on theory. And even now I do. I think that there's a lot of intellectualizing that can create distance or needing or prioritization of certain terms and ideas over others that can, yeah, alienate folks.
Yeah, or like limit how much the value that you're creating through your ideas can actually, what that can actually do in the world.
Totally.
Yeah. Relate to that. And I have to say that's something that I really love about the works that you put out in the world is that they feel really grounded and actionable.
Thank you. That's the hope.
Yeah. Well, it's, you're doing it. All right. So we're going to take a little break for community words, but we'll return to our conversation in just a few minutes.
The A.J. Williams Myers African Roots Center and Radio Kingston celebrate Black History Month. Bishop Desmond Tutu was born on October 7, 1931 in South Africa. His was a life of justice and compassion. In the turbulence of apartheid, Bishop Tutu emerged as a beacon of hope. He advocated tirelessly for human rights and equality, especially for the marginalized in the struggle for justice. In 1984, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, a testament to his unwavering dedication. Beyond his international acclaim, Bishop Tutu's community involvement was evident in the streets of Soweto, where he worked to mend the wounds of apartheid, promoting reconciliation and forgiveness. Today, Bishop Tutu's legacy continues to inspire and nourish our world with the values of love and understanding. Join us as we celebrate the life of this great man. This has been a Black History Month moment from the A.J. Williams Myers African Roots Center and Radio Kingston.
Hi, I'm Jillian Nadiak-Bruck with the Ulster County Department of Mental Health. Opioid use disorder isn't something to hide. You're not alone in this struggle. Certified Recovery Peer Advocates, also known as CERPAs, are a vital support system in the battle against opioid use disorder, offering understanding and guidance from those who have walked similar paths, helping individuals find hope and healing without judgment. And you have access to these amazing services right here in Ulster County. CERPAs empathize because they've been there themselves. Together, we can dismantle the stigma surrounding opioid use disorder and foster a community of compassion and support, ensuring everyone has the opportunity to find the recovery they deserve. If you're grappling with opioid use disorder, know that there's help available. Click on Recovery is Possible and navigate to the Find Treatment tab at ulsterhelps.org.
Circle of Friends for the Dying is hosting an in-person death cafe at Circle Home Saturday, February 22nd. Death cafes are gatherings of people, often strangers, to drink tea or coffee, eat sweet and savory treats, and have a confidential conversation that breaks the taboo against talking about death and dying. It is a discussion group, not a grief or counseling session. Admission is free. You'll just need to register online. In-person Death Cafe, Saturday, February 22nd at 1 p.m. at Jim and Lisa's Circle Home, 100 Wirt Street in Kingston. To register and for more information, visit circlehome.org. Great. So welcome back to Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston. I'm Chris Baker, filling in for Laurel today, and I'm here with Kate Rose Wiener, co-editor of LOAM, the publishing branch of the Weaving Earth Center for Relational Education. And before the break, we were talking about the origin story of LOAM as a DIY college scene that evolved into this beautiful publishing world, basically, unto itself. And it feels consequential to me that Loam has, so a lot of your works to for visitors or listeners who are just tuning in is about climate justice and culture. And it feels consequential to me that Loam has one co-editor on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. Because I think one of the challenges of climate resiliency work is that even though we're all on this together on one level, we're coming from different biomes, and the cultural socioeconomic context of our different areas like can really change, create their own unique challenges. So I'm curious about what your experience has been like curating publications with authors that are coming at these topics from really such diverse viewpoints.
Yeah, I mean, I first have to say I feel so grateful. Kailea Lofton is the co-editor of Loam, and Kailea is just an incredible collaborator and someone who we grew up in very different biomes and very different sociocultural contexts, and we bring that to our work. And I think it's really strengthened the community that we've been able to build because of that. And in terms of, yeah, curating magazines and publications that bring in voices from across the world, I think, I think there is finding a way to both root it in what's rooted in a bioregional connection and also find points of interconnection. And I think that's really specific to each project, that weaving together across worlds. But I think it does help that we both bring, we're both really, especially in this moment, want to inspire people to root in place, to find their community where they can grow, neighbors that they can build networks with, you know, cultivate kinship with the trees and the animals and minerals in their bioregion. And I think more and more that's been a point of focus for us in our work is we're in a moment when I think we're going to really need to deeply know our neighbors. And yeah. I think we've been trying, although Loam isn't specific to any one place, we do try to model a place-based relationship.
And yeah, I know you bring together a lot of authors who are deeply rooted in
yeah, exactly.
in their biomes. Speaking a little bit to the need for rootedness in this time, I know that that's through the research, like a really big determinant of climate resiliency, mm-hmm. right? Can you speak a little bit about the role of knowing your neighbors and like including our more than human kin in that in that definition for dealing with disaster?
Yeah, absolutely. I think exactly that's been one of the big reasons it's been a focus is that since 2018, actually, we've been tending to a project called Compassion in Crisis, which is about learning how to live in an age of disaster. And it's really grounded in community power disaster preparedness models, you know, models of building resilience and cultivating regeneration that challenge that kind of isolationist disaster preparedness.
Right, like the bunker, the billionaire bunker as the extreme example on the other side of it.
One of the big things, you know, we've been tending to this project now for almost 7 years. And one of the big threads that has emerged again and again when we talk to folks who have survived climate disaster is how important it is to know your neighbor. And that means being able to read your landscape. That means knowing your literal physical neighbor, like who lives next door to you and what their needs are and how you can support them in a moment of acute crisis, and they in turn can support you. And I think culturally, right, I think there's a lot of and this is something Kailea talks about, and we're currently working on a new iteration of Compassion in Crisis, but there's a lot of emphasis on transience and travel as models of success. And of course, there's a lot tied into this. It is difficult right now, I would say, I think, to root given housing costs and job challenges and all of that. So I just want to name this as a much bigger discussion than
sure.
The
and well, there's a tension there
between
like wanting to all the values that come with rooting, and also as we see, I mean, there's so many situations in which people are forced from the places where they live. Yeah,
exactly. So I want to name that it's a complicated conversation and far bigger than the context of this.
But if discussion. We're sort of working against the fetishization of like a successful person looks like somebody who's a jet setter.
Yes, basically. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. And moving towards a way like, could you find joy and adventure in your neck of the woods? Absolutely. You know, can you build abundance and connection right where you are? And encouraging a willingness to celebrate that too as a way to be successful in the world. And I think it does feel really important. I know in my own experiences navigating wildfire, this is when I lived in Colorado, where I lived for a while, knowing my landscape really helped, and knowing my neighbors really helped. And I think it's important for us to be in that practice of learning how to read the weather where we are, feeling like we have community that we can connect to, and that, we understand what their needs are and they understand what our needs are. And that's a process, and it's not easy, and it's not a given. You know, there's a lot of reasons it can be difficult to achieve. And also, I do think it's still a goal worth aspiring to, is to build that sense of connection.
Absolutely. Well, and I think like over the years in like getting more and more involved with naturalist hobbies, even just like, you know, pastimes, I feel like it is self-perpetuating though, right? It's like the more that you, the things that you tune into become your world in a lot of ways, and you see what you expect to see. And so if you expect to see, certainly, you know, if you're looking for birds, then you're going to see birds. We had a couple weeks ago, I was sitting here with Mark Didier from the John Burroughs Natural History Society, and he was, I think, compulsive. I don't think it was a choice. I think he was just bird watching when he was sitting where you were. He couldn't help it. But it's like, we see that. And I think, like, also in that process, you usually meet other people.
Yeah.
Which helps.
Yeah. Totally. I know. I've actually, one of my friends and I really bonded over lilacs because we both love lilacs. It's the, we would go, this is when I lived in Colorado, we both would go from like lilac to lilac, just kind of intaking.
Just like inhale.
Inhaling. And that's kind of how we met, is that we both loved flowers. We both loved, like, I don't know the term, lilac bathing.
you met in a lilac bush?
Just like soaking it up. And it was really sweet. Yeah. To like build connection through a shared joy and delight in lilac season.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a beautiful, there's a beautiful metaphor there. we were sort of talking about this a little bit over the last break, but about audience and the challenges of sort of creating publications that you hope to reach a large audience, you know, a large audience because you have this mission-oriented work that you want to have impact, and then also the challenges of writing for a diverse audience, or editing for them. I'm curious, since within that, as the reach of Loam expands over time, who you most hope will find Loam publications?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, you know, in many ways, Kaylee and I talked about this, but Loam has really grown up with us. Mm-hmm. And because of that, our audience is changing. But I would love to still, for teens and college students to still feel at home in Loam. In part because, I mean, I still feel I'm figuring my way out in the world. But when I was in that moment of my life, Loam and the community I was able to build through Loam was so grounding. I'd love if it could still connect with readers in that space. And I would love folks who feel like, you know, one of the things, Kylie and I, that's really important to us is to share stories from people who might not identify as writers. I mean, there's so many ways to be an incredible storyteller. And we want to always Yeah, work with people who have a beautiful story to tell regardless of how they identify. So I hope that people who don't feel maybe that they identify with those terms can still find a home in Loam.
I love that so much. I mean, this is just a personal piece, but I think the terms writer and artist are so loaded and so unhelpful in so many ways. I mean, obviously, it's a great way to identify. I support artists and writers who identify. I mean, I identify that way myself, but I also feel like it's a human birthright.
Mm-hmm,
it is all of our birthright to tell stories and to create art, and segmenting out people. I mean, it really does. Yeah. It's a weird thing to do, and I feel it's not a way that, I mean, not that obviously people who are great at telling stories have always been prized, I'm sure, in human societies, but everybody can tell a story, right?
Totally.
And everybody has a story to tell.
Yeah, exactly. And we've had contributors, express doubt, I didn't go to school for writing, or, I don't have an MFA or whatever. And it's that doesn't,
nobody does.
That doesn't make you a writer or not. There's so many ways to be a creative, to contribute, to be a storyteller. And I hope that Loam can be a small part of showing that diversity of expression.
I love that. And also, I just have to say, I really appreciate you as an editor, because I feel editors are undersung people in this world. But it's really it's a kind of midwifery. It's really... Yeah.
Oh, I really appreciate that, because that's also something Kylie and I laugh about, is it's a relational art and it's very invisible.
It is. If it's done well, it's completely invisible,
And I think the work of editing in so many ways, it's really about surrendering your ego to the story. You have to work with the contributor. You're working together to figure out what is the story and how do we decenter our own egos to serve the story. And it's, at its best, it's a very beautiful and complicated and relational process.
Yeah, also deeply emotional labor. Time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe even more so working with people who identify as writers. I wonder. And then this kind of touches into something. Well, you were talking about hoping that younger people will find a home in Loam. And I definitely feel like that makes sense to me in this moment, too, because I think there's a real backlash brewing to social media culture, especially for younger people. I mean, for everybody, but it seems like it's reaching a bit of a breaking point. Maybe I just hope that. I don't know, but... both you and Kylie have written really beautifully about your reasons for divesting from social media, and even before the most recent news about this topic, and a lot of people wanting to divest from Meta for political reasons, but on a cultural level, you've talked about it, and I know you created a Substack newsletter that was part of the divestment, but you've also now created a physical newsletter, which I think is a really cool addition to your offerings. And I was just hoping you could talk to listeners a little bit about the decision to divest, and then what you hope the newsletter will bring.
Yeah, absolutely. So the decision to divest was something Kylie and I had talked about for years, and it's still something we're puzzling through, particularly as you get ready to release Compassion and Crisis next year. And I think, I think for both of us, it had reached a place of exhaustion and burnout. I'll say for myself, I was realizing, in this moment, you have to be so discerning and particular with attention, and our energy is limited. I mean, just by virtue of being humans with bodily needs,
existing in a 24-hour day.
Yeah, there's a cap on what we can give. And I had the realization, I'm putting more effort into the articulation of what I'm doing for social media than actually doing the thing. And some people can do both, but I can't, and I want to just do the thing. And I had to make that decision for myself and realize if it means not expressing it, that's okay. I'd rather be in the work. And again, some people can do both, but I realized I couldn't. So that was part of my own personal decision to divest, is I want to more meaningfully focus on in-person organizing and community and remove the need to articulate it, which was taking a lot out of me, for a certain audience. So that was the initial desire to divest. And I mean, there was also just, questions around engagement on that platform and what it means and, what we're supporting and asking of our audience. And I think both of us were like, we really want to make sure that we are nothing we offer is filler. We want it to feel like it honors our own capacities as people who balance loan with full-time jobs. And we want it to feel like it honors the attention of our readers, that it feels intentional and pointed. And since then, we've really, both of us love letter writing. Like, it brings us a lot of joy. I mean, we're both just like big book nerds, like print ephemera type, people. And I think for years, Kalea had been dreaming of this print newsletter. Last fall, in partnership with Weaving Earth, we kind of launched a newsletter that was really meant to, you open it kind of like a map, and it had an invocation from Weaving Earth, poetry, herbal remedies, an essay by Kalea on divesting from social media, and the hope is to kind of offer something for people that feels beautiful, joyful, invites them into an embodied reading experience, and is an alternative, and encourages focus and attention.
I mean, I think that that's, from my experience reading it, the amount of information on it was really, really appreciated it, because it's like I have a stack of books at all times that I'm trying to get through. I'm trying to get my attention away from the little bits and bytes of information constantly flooding my phone.
Yeah.
I would actually compare a little bit, like reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's most recent book, which is The Service Berry. Mm-hmm. Robin Wall Kimmerer is like a indigenous botanist and just wonderful thinker and writer. And her most famous book is Braiding Sweetgrass, and it's very long and wonderful and dense. And then her most recent book is like almost like a novella, but nonfiction style. And both the Loam newsletter and the Service Berry, I kind of read in like lovely part of an afternoon. Mm. And I feel like because it's accomplishable in that way, to be able to complete a reading assignment.
Yeah, totally.
Feels really, like, in terms of the type of attention that it brings, like, it felt different and good. Yeah. It's not like a stack on your...
Totally. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, it's just meant to be like a little dose. And one of the things that's brought me so much joy over the years is when readers share snapshots of either picnics they prepared to savor while reading Loam, or just like ways they've turned it into an experience. And likewise, that was the hope with the newsletter. It's like, I want it to be like, it's the morning, you open it up, you have your tea. Like, it's a moment and it's a ritual.
I think more than the map experience, it reminded me a little bit of like getting a newspaper, which I haven't gotten for years. And the experience of like opening it, because it's kind of like big.
It's big.
And you have to figure out how to fold it so that you can read the section that you're reading. It definitely feels like you can't do it without a cup of tea or coffee. Nice. Yeah.
That's the hope with all Loam books, is you need to have your tea.
It's very like, the content and the form match, which feels, I think that's such a struggle for everybody who's trying to navigate social media right now, is it's like,
it's dissonant.
Yeah. When what you're trying to offer is something that's community oriented or grounded or in the physical world. And then you're like, but I'm asking you to look at your phone to receive this information.
Right. And to have your attention be splintered by a platform that just kind of punts you from one thing to the next.
Yeah, pretty intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a little bit, you touched on earlier compassion and crisis, which I failed to mention the first time, but is going to come out from Heyday Books in 2026, mm-hmm. which is really exciting. And that I assume will mean like an expanded audience from the first iteration.
Yes, we totally reworked it. So it'll be revised, an expanded iteration. This version in particular is, over the years that we've been working on compassion and crisis, we've had a lot of educators share that they want to weave it into curriculum. So it'll have more questions for reflection and more practices to be done with community. Our hope is that we would love if people had community gatherings to talk about what emergency preparedness means within their particular biome and context, and to feel like there's enough in the guide to structure conversation or inspire action.
That's awesome. And because I know we were talking about it before the break too, but the original iteration, and well, I guess I'm curious, like, how the new edition, in addition to the form changes, like, how has starting a project, because you said you originally started the project 6 years ago, right?
Yeah, in 2018 or 2019.
I feel like the world has, in some ways we're facing the same,
yeah,
a lot of the same issues as before, but it feels like a lot has also changed. I'm curious, like, in the content as well, how it has been, like, working on a book about disaster resilience in a time of unfolding disasters.
I mean, it's definitely, the conditions are very different from when we started it. One, I'll say a big impetus for the book is, at the time, it was the first book we published through Loam, and I had reached out to Kailea with a desire to publish a book and not knowing what. And at the time, Kailea had just found out she was pregnant with what was then one of the worst wildfires, during what was then one of the worst wildfires in Northern California, where she was living at the time. And so it's interesting, that book has really tracked that journey and that change. And I mean, it's different in the sense that, one, our own relationship to disaster has evolved, just as we've grown as people and as we have experienced disaster. I think the landscape just surrounding disaster has evolved. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I think it's really, I feel, yeah, when we were starting, it was much harder for us to find material. And I feel really grateful now that, you know, when I turn to social media in the aftermath of a disaster, I see many more resources from communities, which I think is really beautiful and exciting shift. And, but yeah, when we started, I think unprecedented had more meaning. Yeah. It doesn't really now. I think it was harder. I mean, there were some great books. You know, we really loved Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell. That was a great one for us.
That feels really connected to the work.
Yeah. But a lot of what was out there was very, like, isolationist, prepper, kind of, like, bunker narrative. Or it was, like, a government...
It's like, do you have your AA batteries?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like, very academic or detached. And we really wanted something that was, like, when you think about disaster preparedness from a community lens, your before, during, and after plan is very different. And also, there really is no before, during, and after. The disaster is emergent and it's ongoing, and that's the reality of our time. And even in the time that we've been writing this, just tracking the scale of disasters that have hit either us or our loved ones, it's been immense. So I think that's really changed too. And we both have been like, we don't know what the world... I mean, I think that's always a risk in publishing.
I was going to say that the speed of publishing versus the speed of the world right now.
Right. You're like,
a challenge.
I don't know what it's going to be like in a year. I think this the information will be continue to be relevant and evergreen, but it's true. So much is changing so fast. I mean, the conditions are changing very rapidly.
Well, I am very eager for 2026's book releases on a lot of levels, and Compassion and Crisis is high on my list. All right, so I'd like to take a break for some community words, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Kate Rose Wiener.
Are you ready to get active and thrive? Come join us at the YMCA. I'm Heidi Kirshner, CEO, President of the YMCA, and we're excited to offer you a wide range of activities for everyone. Fitness classes, youth sports, swim lessons, diabetes prevention, blood pressure monitoring, and vibrant community events. It's the perfect place to build friendships, stay active, and make a positive impact on your community. Visit your local YMCA today on Broadway in Kingston or at ymcaulster.org. We can't wait to see you.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices.
One community.
This is the Rev, Reverend Charles Stickley, inviting you to join me on Morning Meditation on Sunday morning at 7:30.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird.
We have music, we have the Word of God, we have a meditation, and we spend some time together to honor and to worship God. You're welcome to join me. It all takes place here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm Chris Baker, and my guest today is the co-editor of LOAM, which is the publishing branch of the Weaving Earth Center for Relational Education, Kate Rose Wiener. And we've just been having, I think, a generative and lovely conversation about some pretty heavy topics, including disaster resilience and this time of, what is it that we're calling it now, the meta, or the multi, yeah. Multi-die, I can't remember the word, but overlapping disasters that mm-hmm. we are trying to support each other through. And LOAM publications are a great tool for that. But I'd love to also pivot to just some lighter topics that might inspire some joy and inspire that connection that we're hoping people get out into the world and seek. I'm curious if there's an everyday sight in our ecosystem that always inspires awe for you. You are in the, like, no matter how many times you see it, we kind of talked about like a word that loses its meaning over time, but like a sight that just always fills you up.
Ooh, well, that's a good question. I think I'm an easily enchanted person, which I feel grateful for. I mean, I never get tired of gardens in any stage of their life cycle. I find them beautiful and magical, the care they reveal.
You're also an herbalist in yeah. addition to
So I think that's part of it. I mean, yeah, for me, being out in the woods, you see beloved herbs at different stages in their life cycle, and that's always such a joy. I mean, I just think plants are beautiful. They're always awe-inspiring to me.
Do you have a relationship to seed saving this time of year, or it's in the fallow season?
You know, I think just because I've been in an unintentionally, I've had to move around a lot the last few years, I haven't been able to really ground in those ways. Mm-hmm. But in years past, I have. And it's brought me a lot of joy. And I think seeds, I recently had a friend very sweetly, I'd had to move, which meant I had to leave my calendula nasturtium plants that I was tending to, and they saved some of the seeds for me.
Oh, that's so nice.
Which was really sweet. It was actually a beautiful birthday gift. And I was just holding the seeds in my hand and thinking, these are so incredibly beautiful.
Like the calendula seeds are so cool. Yeah.
Just like, it was just, yeah. I just was like, I can't believe this exists. It was really special.
And a plant just makes it like, it's like, yeah. It's like, I mean, you look at animal eggs and they're so boring compared to plants. All the adaptations.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's wonderful. And speaking to the intergenerational part of the work that you do, I'm curious if you could go back and teach Kid Kate about something about the natural world. I know you did grow up, you know, with an understanding, but as you said, as we grow up, our understandings change so much over time. Like, what would you share with yourself if you could?
I actually think that one of the things I would have encouraged my younger self to do is claim my love of herbalism and flowers more confidently, because I think more in the last few years I've really come to claim that. But when I was growing up, I loved, as I shared, I went to a nature-based after school program that I really loved, and I was also the only girl in the program. I think sometimes, which doesn't necessarily mean anything, but my experience was that of just sometimes feeling I didn't really want to make fire or build things the same way, which again you can do regardless of how you identify, but all that to say, I felt that at the time I wasn't able to fully embrace that love. I felt shame of it, maybe because the ways we've shamed things that we code as femme, even though they're things that everyone can honor and celebrate.
Absolutely. It hurts everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what I would like to go back is be like, regardless of how this passion of yours is coded and worthy and beautiful of celebrating, and you can claim that as something powerful and fierce and valid. I think I was always, when I was a kid, a little sensitive. Like what I liked was not cool or edgy because it was a softer skill, or maybe more relational.
I love that. That's such a good, I think that there's people of every age who can use that piece of wisdom right now. So for listeners who want to follow the work that you're doing with Loam, and I hope that's everybody, can you talk about how people can stay abreast of your publications, or maybe even get involved if they have short stories to share?
Absolutely. You can follow us on Substack at loamlove.substack.com.
I'll link that in the show notes too.
Thank you. We'll be primarily focusing on sharing behind the scenes of our process of editing Compassion in Crisis. We'll be pulling from our archives beautiful interviews and essays from Loam contributors. And we'll also be offering some new print publications in the coming year. And that'll be the best place to stay tuned. And also encourage folks, if you don't follow Weaving Earth, to go to weavingearth.org to learn about their educational immersions. Some of their programs are online and are just incredible resources for meeting this moment.
And when they have another newsletter, make sure to order that sent to your house and give yourself a treat, too. Well, it's been so great having you in the studio today, Kate. I really appreciate your time and all of the work that you do for all of us. Even though a lot of your editorial work is invisible, it's making waves in the world. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
And also I want to circle back for listeners who weren't tuned in the beginning and shout out that this is in fact the weekend for the Great Backyard Bird Count. So again, if you want to contribute to community science and bird conservation, and also just like watch birds in the process, who doesn't want to do that, you can head to birdcount.org. Or for local events, you can go to the John Burroughs Natural History Society website, which is jbnhs.org, and click over to the events tab. Thanks so much for listening to Nature Nuggets today here on Radio Kingston. I'll be back again next week filling in for Laurel, and you can feel free to email us with suggestions or questions by contacting naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. And you can also follow the Nature Nuggets Instagram account at hvnaturenuggets.com. I mean, hvnaturenuggets, although if you're divesting from social media, we approve. Have a great day.
Expressed on this program are not necessarily